Good afternoon. Case number 02-1945, Akeem Akiquam versus Cecil Davis. Mr. Creason. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the court. The Indiana Supreme Court, in this case regarding the peremptory challenge claim, their decision was both consistent with and a reasonable application of Batson v. Kentucky and its progeny and other decisions from the United States Supreme Court. Because of this, the district court erred in granting habeas relief to the petitioner. Batson is a procedure that necessarily requires, in order for it to be applied properly, an objection by one of the parties.
And Mr. Creason, I wonder if we could establish something factual to begin with. I have looked at the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion on direct appeal very carefully, which is the one where they discuss this issue, and I can't find any place where they say we are adopting for Indiana a rule that goes beyond the federal Batson rules. Instead, they construe Batson, they have quotes from Batson, they have quotes from Hernandez, they have a discussion of all of this, and then they address the two issues that are comprised within what you're talking about, the first one being whether there was any problem with the trial court sua sponte going into this. But then secondly, and I'll be honest with you, the part of this case that worries me more is the second, whether the defense in fact proffered sufficiently race-neutral justifications and whether that part of the case was properly handled. And it's that second part that really concerns me. And the only reason I point the first thing out is that if I had read in the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion a statement such as, we're not going to have peremptory challenges anymore in Indiana, states can probably make such a decision, and this would strike me as a different case. But I don't read them as saying that. Do you?
No.
Okay.
Although, to a certain... I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
To a certain extent, the court is careful to say that with regard to the sua sponte raising, it is not against federal law. They don't necessarily say that their decision is based on federal law. It also doesn't say state law, but it seems to imply by their saying that in our authority to regulate the courts of this state, we find that this procedure is disfavored, although permissible.
Right, and I guess I was trying to say, let's sort of tuck that issue off to the side. Assume you're right. Assume that there's nothing wrong with the ball getting rolling by the district court or the trial court judge, as happened here. We still have the other part, which for me is more difficult.
Mm-hmm. Then to begin to address that discrete issue, the concern, the overall problem, and part of the reason why I believe it's difficult at first glance to get one's hands around it to understand the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion, is because the Batson inquiry is based on burdens of proof. One party, in order to stop another party from exercising its statutorily granted peremptory challenges must carry a certain burden. When the trial court, a neutral entity and concerned with the overall proceedings, institutes the inquiry, that burden doesn't really exist in a certain way.
But how can that be? I mean, I've struggled with this too, because I suppose it's one thing for the trial court to put the issue on the table, but quite another to derive from that fact what appears to have happened here, where the burden of showing a non-racial motivation falls on the party attempting to exercise the peremptory challenge. And I'm actually a little surprised that the state of Indiana would want such a rule, since that's going to hurt prosecutors at least as often as it's going to hurt defendants to bear this burden of showing, when I say she was the only lady who raised her hand, and the judge says, I'm not sure that that's as much as you need, therefore I'm going to presume that it's race discrimination. There's a universe of reasons that it might be, and why one jumps to race discrimination is very odd.
And the trial court was not presuming a racial discrimination.
But how can you say that when the trial court focuses on whether the explanation was sufficiently clear and reasonable? And I actually found all of these explanations crystal clear. Whether they were well supported is a different matter, and maybe you needed, you know, a small treatise about it instead of a sentence. But it's pretty easy to say, I didn't think this person, you know, understood the case, or I didn't think this lady understood the presumption of innocence. I understand those reasons. I'm sure you do too.
Yes. But the trial court made it clear in its pretrial discussions over this procedure and explaining why it was going to be, it wanted to eliminate the possibility of racial or religious-based or sexual or gender-based discrimination. The trial court was not presuming there was racial discrimination, merely that the parties couldn't show or did not show.
But where is there a shred of discrimination evidence in this record?
Well, one telling example may be that these four peremptory strikes that are now being discussed were not all of them that were denied.
I wanted to ask about that. Did the court require reasons for all peremptories for both parties, are only for blacks stricken by the government and whites stricken by AKQM?
Every strike that was proposed, this is neutral on its face, any strike that was proposed had to be, the reasons had to be adequately supported by the record to the trial court. It wasn't necessarily that it had to eliminate racial pretext. It had to be that there was a reason that was adequately supported by the record, so the trial court was comfortable in that there was not an ulterior motive.
Well, only required a challenge for cause is what it required.
Yeah.
Not totally, however, well, admittedly close.
Well, a challenge for cause is a walk away, but what did he require that wasn't a challenge for cause? What would he take that was less?
An explanation that was, I can't point to specific, I can't give you a citation to the record off the top of my head.
Oh.
I don't believe I have them in my notes. I apologize for that. The state offered at least two, I believe, and defendant others that were granted, or that the strikes were granted.
Right, and what reasons did the state give for those two peremptory challenges?
I'm unable to give.
See, what I would want to know is how were those reasons qualitatively different from the reasons that were given by Mr. AKQM's counsel for the peremptories denied, you know, by the trial court. I mean, I would want to know what was the race of the jurors that the government sought to strike.
unfortunately, the record is only clear as to the rates of the four that I could discern from the record.
So in other words, I could search the record and I'd never find out the answer?
The answer to every one of them, that is correct. There was some discussion at the district court level as to what the ultimate composition of the jury was. We were not able to definitively determine that. There is no record of that, either in the prosecutor's files, defense counsel's files, or the trial court's files. However, there are affidavits in the district court record.
And bystanders, bills of exception, did somebody sit down and say that he was there and there were so many blacks and so many whites, so many women, so many men?
Not on the record, and this trial was over 10 years ago, and so prosecutor...
The law was still in effect 10 years ago. I mean, wouldn't you think somebody keeps score? I mean, what are your...
Yes, and we believe that at some point in time that was. I mean, it would be very strange to believe, given this procedure and the concern over...
Well, this procedure was a little strange, so everything that happened after that was not particularly any more eerie.
Yeah. I was unable to find in the record where these things existed. They may exist or have existed, but we're unable. The petitioner, however, at the district court submitted an affidavit by himself and of one female black juror, or a non-Caucasian juror, as she referred to herself, and they believed, through their recollection, that the jury was made up of, 11 whites and one non-white.
Is the juror the non-white juror?
Yes.
File the affidavit?
Yes. But, obviously, petitioner's affidavit is self-serving to some extent, and
nobody
state did not challenge that. We have no reason to challenge it. And
what county? What county again was this?
Lake County. The crimes were committed in Gary.
But I want to go back to what you just said a few minutes ago about and believe me, I have no question, but this was what was in the trial judge's mind. He wanted to make sure that there was no taint of discrimination of any impermissible kind. But still, we have, for example, from the Indiana Supreme Court's opinion, juror Sosnowitzky, and the defense counsel says he didn't get the impression that he, the juror, really understood what was going on. Now, if he had phrased that by saying, I didn't, or if he had actually just flat said, I don't think juror Sosnowitzky understands what's happening here, I myself can't see where the racial or the gender or the ethnic or the religious or whatever basis exists in such a statement, and surely from the Supreme Court's opinion, where even Spanish-speaking isn't an equivalent for Hispanic, one couldn't do that. And what worries me is something from the statement the Supreme Court said in Perquette, where it criticized the Court of Appeals there for requiring the justification actually be a persuasive one. And that's exactly where the Supreme Court overruled the lower court in that case. So it seems to me you have a real problem, since not understanding isn't, facially speaking, in this instance, a racist reason for striking a juror. And I wish I could find something in the record that gave me a hint that the trial judge went on to the next question and made an affirmative finding that nonetheless this was an action of intentional discrimination, which is the only thing that's prohibited. Where can I get that?
There is no finding of intentional discrimination in Mr. Sonikowski's voir dire, or in the challenge. However, there is...
the others, right? For Wilson, Boblick, and Brandy? I didn't see a finding of intentional discrimination, and it strikes me that in the absence of a statement from the Supreme Court of Indiana that they are really changing the law at the state level for Indiana altogether, this is simply a legal error under Batson.
Respectfully, the real question isn't whether or not defendants.
Judge Wood's permission. Let me reenact this all. After the peremptory strike was denied, peremptory strike, I assume, was not done in the presence of the juror.
I don't believe so.
So was there further interrogation of the jurors after the peremptory was denied? A way to explore the problem? That is, I offer a peremptory and give a reason that the judge says is inadequate. Do I get another shot at seeing whether I can fill out the blanks and find out whether, for instance, the last witness, the last juror, really did understand what the hell was going on, or he was at sea completely?
Counsel did not request an opportunity to do that, and so the trial court...
Did the court, since the court decided he was going to run the show all by himself, did he give them an opportunity or offer to them an opportunity to proceed to develop the issue?
No, and the
well, you just said requirement. You just said no, so you can't use a peremptory, and then we go ahead and swear him in.
No, that isn't true. The defendant or his counsel offered the reason, and then the trial court gave its concern.
And then
defendant. Sometimes there was some go-between, some discussion on the issue.
Between court and counsel?
Yes.
I want colloquy between the counsel and the prospective juror, or the court and the prospective juror.
I don't have that text in front of me.
Did you see whether there's any way to allay the fears of the defense attorney that the juror was inadequate? Other than the fact he said, no, I don't think it's a good enough reason.
Yes, the defense counsel knew of this procedure, and the state, too.
Well,
everyone knew.
He told ahead of time what was going to happen.
That's right. And yet, the only, for Mr. Sonikowski, to begin with him, the only thing petitioner's counsel could give were his general impressions that he wasn't being truthful. Yet he knew that in order to get a peremptory challenge, he needed evidence that was in the record, and there wasn't any discussion as to...
Where did that rule come from? It's certainly not in Batson. All you have to do is articulate a non-discriminatory reason. I thought he was being evasive. I thought he didn't understand. I didn't think she understood the presumption of innocence. Those are, you know, as Judge Bauer said, if you were in the world of challenges for cause, of course, you have to back up those kinds of statements with something very concrete. But in the world of peremptories, those aren't discriminatory reasons. Those are reasons that could apply to anybody.
They're actually
that is true.
The dictionary definition of peremptory, as far as I can see.
Yeah. The question here, the question that this court should address is whether or not defendant was denied his right under the Constitution to use his peremptories, not whether or not Batson was violated.
You've got your finger right on the money. But if in the process of applying Batson you wind up denying him his right to a peremptory challenge, you have denied him his constitutional right to peremptory challenges, haven't you?
Except he does not have a constitutional right to peremptory challenges.
If you give both sides the right to peremptory challenge, you have built it into the system. He had a right to due process of law as a constitutional matter. Due process of law in Indiana, as I understand it, includes the right to peremptory challenges in criminal cases.
Yes, and
if you deny him that, you've denied him due process of law.
Only if the procedure used was fundamentally unfair or...
No. If you deny him the right to peremptory challenges, no matter what system you use, you've denied him his due process of law if, in theory, he was supposed to have the right to peremptory challenges. Do we start with the premise he had a right to peremptory challenges?
That is correct.
So a due process of law then would require that he get the peremptory challenges. So no matter what system the trial court evolved to prevent him from using his peremptory challenges, if he did deny him, that's a violation of his constitutional right to due process. Am I correct so far?
Yes, in the appropriate circumstances, that's correct.
Well, in any circumstances. We'll do it in the abstract, but I mean in any circumstances where the trial judge denies the defendant his right to peremptory challenges, he's violated his constitutional right to due process of law. Can I get the answer first?
I want to know what...
Well, can I get my answer to the question I've asked?
I'd like to add to your question. What would make it inappropriate?
Before you do, could I get an answer to my question, and then you may inquire all you want.
Is my short answer. However, I want to add on to that, I guess, with a caveat, which is that so long as the procedure that was used to deny someone, quote, deny a peremptory challenge, was acceptable under state law, and the Indiana Supreme Court, from its opinion, does not find that this violated federal or state law in any way. The trial court, and in fact, the Indiana Supreme Court says that in circumstances, and it is vague as to when the circumstances may be that a trial court could sua sponte use this procedure, where discrimination is utterly apparent, it would be appropriate.
If I recall correctly, the Supreme Court said that not only are we trying to protect the rights of the litigants, we're also trying to protect the constitutional rights of the jurors. So in a case where a child was trying to protect the rights of the jurors, that would be appropriate. But I don't think that's what you have in this case, nor do I think that that was a rule enunciated by the Supreme Court of Indiana. They just said this met Batson. And if in process of making Batson, it denies somebody their constitutional right to peremptory challenges, why isn't it a violation of due process?
Because the parties were aware of the procedure to be used and could not follow that procedure that the trial court
They were aware of the fact that they were being denied their constitutional rights to peremptory challenges?
Respectfully, Your Honor, the superintendent does not view it in that way.
Then I won't require that you confess error. Go ahead.
The United States Supreme Court, it is true, this procedure does not comport with the strict Batson requirement.
Worse than that, it's not just that it's not strictly Batson, because the court has shown some flexibility, but it's the combination of the fact that the Indiana Supreme Court reiterates that under state law in Indiana you have peremptories, reiterates that it's following Batson, and yet underlying Batson is also an equal protection theme, where the court has said intentional discrimination is the only thing that will suffice to deprive somebody of the right to the peremptory challenge that's otherwise granted by the applicable law. And we're, of course, here on the Anti-Terrorism Act habeas review, and we're looking to see if there was either a decision of the Indiana Supreme Court contrary to established U.S. Supreme Court rules or a misapplication of it. And if the Indiana Supreme Court adopted a Batson rule that doesn't require intentional discrimination, that sounds to me like it's contrary to U.S. Supreme Court law. That's why I keep stressing. I don't see them saying we're making up a new rule for Indiana. They're saying we're following it, but we're misapplying it.
I agree. It does not appear that they are making a distinctly new state inquiry under this. However, the trial court, it was not, the trial court did not believe the explanations that were given to it.
Believe those, but that doesn't mean that the explanation is that there was intentional racial discrimination. Right? I mean, you have to admit that just because maybe it's not because the defense counsel had a sound enough basis for saying he doesn't really understand what he's going on, that, I mean, hopefully we don't live in a world where the alternative explanation is always intentional racial discrimination.
The Indiana Supreme Court and the trial court agreed that when the parties knew that they had to give a reason that was supported by the record, and that was the key,
element, but that's where I see the key legal error, because the Indiana Supreme Court seems to think that the case turned on whether it was a sufficiently clear and reasonably specific explanation, and it never even reached the question of whether the failure of such an explanation led to the inference of intentional discrimination. It's just a gaping hole in the analysis.
And that is because the Indiana Supreme Court deferred to the ultimate finding of whether or not the trial court found or believed to be intentional discrimination, whether racial or other.
The trial court never said that either. The words intentional discrimination never come out of the trial judge's mouth.
And Batson or any of the United States Supreme Court doesn't require the word intentional discrimination to come out of a judge's mouth. The functional equivalent to it does. And the trial court believes the, to my knowledge, the United States Supreme Court has never required that a judge say, use the magic words, I find intentional discrimination.
What if this trial judge struck those jurors, or refused to strike those jurors because he wanted as many white people on the jury as possible? Hypothetically, there could be such a judge out there.
Certainly.
Don't we need a record?
Yes. And the defendant was unable, under the procedure that was clear to him, was unable to give any reasons that were, in fact, supported by the record.
Absent a violation of Batson, can you think of any reason why you could deprive somebody of his right to a peremptory challenge? I mean, pre-Batson, all I had to do was say, the defendant will excuse juror number 6, prosecution will excuse number 7, you didn't have to give any say. So until Batson, the peremptory challenge, you could use him beyond him. So that when you say the you don't have to say the words that we find it as a violation of Batson or that there's been intentional discrimination. It is an absolute that you have to have someplace in a record an indication that the reason I'm depriving you of your right to a peremptory challenge is because I think you're using an invidious reason to get rid of somebody that is protected under Batson. Right?
Yes.
Where in the record do we find that any indication that the judge thought that there was an invidious use of Batson, the preppery.
The trial court believed at each of these stages in the record he discusses. Yes, however, he does not say the words intentional discrimination.
Well, that's the only way he can stop him from a preppery challenge is by saying that I think your challenge is really a thinly disguised whack at somebody who's going to be protected by this.
And the trial court did make that indication, and
didn't. Go ahead.
And the record doesn't tell us about the government strikes. So we're really at sea, are we not?
The record does include the government strikes and the reasons for that, and the two strikes that were allowed, defendants' two strikes that were allowed, and the one that was disallowed. The record does include the entire voir dire, if that's what you're asking. I'm sorry, I may have misunderstood you.
Okay, because I asked you earlier the reasons for the state's two preemptories, and you said you could not tell me that. But you're saying that the record will?
Yes,
and
I do not have that in front of me, and I apologize.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, the state requests the reverse.
Okay. Mr. Westerfield.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I believe I can answer some of the questions about the record, and I'd probably like to do that first.
That would be very helpful.
First of all, in regard to the state's exercise of a peremptory challenge, they challenged a Mr. Teague, a black postal worker from Gary, Indiana. Their rationale or the justification that they offered was that his son had been convicted in Marion County some 20 year or 15, 16 years earlier of a...
So that's a reason, isn't it?
Right.
Good reason?
That's a race-neutral reason.
Yes. Amen.
But I'm not aware, I don't recall the justification they offered for the second juror that they struck.
But his honor would not permit that peremptory either on that.
I don't believe that there... it would not be our position that...
Well, you don't have to argue for them.
Yeah, I don't have to argue for them, but I don't recall that sticking out in my mind that...
Were you the trial lawyer?
No.
Were you there for the trial?
No. I was not there for the trial.
But you've made yourself totally familiar with the transcript.
Yes. And I was, sorry.
You will suggest to admit, I presume, that in order to protect jurors and their constitutional right not to be discriminated against, the dishonor of so many two attorneys pay no attention to it, the dishonor could come in under certain circumstances,
yes,
and protect the jurors.
Yes. And our position would be that there is nothing wrong with a trial judge who sees evidence of discrimination occurring from interjecting and asking for explanations. That is not the issue in this case. There was no evidence, no suggestion, no appearance.
Would you suggest he could do that up front, as was done in this case, or would he have to wait to see some indication?
We would submit that he would have to.
There has to be some indication.
Yes, because Batson was a decision based on weighing the importance of peremptory challenges to a fair and impartial jury and the rights of the defendant not to be discriminated against, and ultimately in the subsequent cases of the jurors not to be discriminated against.
I suppose I should have looked this up myself, but some months or years ago, Judge Botley of the circuit court, district court in New York, said she was going to eliminate all preliminary. And does anybody have any idea? Do you have any idea what happened to that brilliant idea? I mean,
no. I think Judge
died of boring.
I think Judge Marshall actually wrote that in one of the Batson opinions.
Yeah, he said he ought to, but it. I think Constance Motley said she was going to abolish it in her court. I was just curious as to whether she was able to successfully perpetrate that in the world at large, or whether somebody called her up short. Nobody knows. Huh?
Yeah, I don't know. The other thing, in reference to the race of jurors who were on this veneer, I became involved in the habeas proceedings, and we searched the record in the trial court and on appeal to try to reconstruct the race of all the jurors, but the questionnaires did not have information about race anywhere in them. The best we could do was, when Judge Sharp asked us, we did seek out to try to determine the racial composition of the actual jury. And the actual jury, we supplemented the record at Judge Sharp's request with an affidavit from one of the jurors stating what that composition was. And I believe it was actually two non-Caucasians, one African-American and one non-Caucasian, and then 10 Caucasians on this jury that decided this case. As I said, we tried to, but we could not find that in the record.
Mr. Westerfeld, I wonder if I could ask you a question sort of implicitly raised by some of what Judge Bauer was talking about. Is it your position that Mr. Akikwam, that some right to peremptory challenges was taken away from him by what happened, or is it your position that this is fundamentally a due process claim? In which case I would say, you know, process was happening, you know, whether it was due or not, you know, I don't know, but is it an equal protection claim? And given the fact that the Supreme Court has said in other contexts that there is no sort of bare constitutional right to peremptories, I want to get a sense of the real essence of your legal position for your client.
Yes. Thank you. The essence of our position is that we are cognizant of the U.S. Supreme Court cases that say there is no federal constitutional right to peremptory challenges. However, in the state of Indiana, every other defendant has an absolute right to peremptory challenges, and in capital cases, you have a right to 20.
There's no right to a right to appeal as a matter of constitutional law, but once you give it to somebody,
right,
everybody gets it.
And that was conferred by, it's conferred by statute, and the interesting thing, this is the only case decided by the Indiana Supreme Court where they upheld the denial of those peremptory challenges to a capital defendant. A case decided the same day, Donald Curran versus State of Indiana, 669-976, which was also before the same judge. I'm not sure exactly when the trial was, but it was before the same trial judge. The court reversed Mr. Curran's conviction. Now, they reversed it and said the explanation that that the defense had offered was sufficient under their standard. But this case is the only one that I could find in surveying the Indiana Supreme Court and Court of Appeals cases.
Isn't the very bottom line of your position that the trial court here simply did not follow Perkins?
I would say that is crystal clear. And interestingly, the state does not at all, in either its lead brief or reply brief, deal with application of Perkett versus Elam, and quite clearly under clearly established law under Griffith versus Kentucky, that case applied. This appeal was still pending when Perkett was decided, and Perkett is really not new law. It is in essence a reaffirmation of what the court had said in Hernandez and the previous cases. The question when the justification is offered is not whether or not it is persuasive, substantial, reasonable. That court said that's not it.
Yeah, you just have to understand what it is. I mean, in that sense, it does have to be clear.
Right.
You can't just sort of say something really vague so you can't tell what the statement is.
Now,
but it can be sillier based on an impression.
Right. And in this case, it's not even silly. Now, the Indiana Supreme Court and the state suggest that the record doesn't support what the defense offered as race-neutral explanations for their strike. But if you look at closely at the questioning, for instance, with Juror Sosnowski, okay, the defense says, I don't think he really knows what's going on here. If you go look back at his questioning, he says such things as... I thought I had it marked. He's being asked about procedures. Do you understand the procedures that we're going to follow in this case? And Sosnowski says, I think so. Okay? So, you know, if you are a trial attorney and you're voir direing jurors, this is not an exact science when you are voir direing jurors. If you see in the way they answer the question, their body language, and you have the impression that maybe they don't understand what we're doing here today, that is a sufficient justification under Perkett and under Batson and under any other case law, any other case from the U.S. Supreme Court. If you look at, I think it's Juror Bobulik, and excuse me if I'm mispronouncing that name, the defense counsel said...
The lady who didn't raise her hand.
Didn't raise her hand when he's asking about the presumption of innocence. That is a fundamental principle that trial counsel is interested in finding jurors who are going to be able to apply that and understand that.
Do we know how many, from the record, how many people were in the box or how many people were raising their hands?
I believe, although I'm not sure the record would show this, but I believe it was 12 at a time in the jury box.
So 11 people raised their hands, yes. And she
yes.
does not.
Yes. And this is a jury that had just seen a video as part of the jury orientation program in Lake County, and they refer to it in their questioning. They hear a jury orientation video that talks about some of these principles that they're going to be having to apply if they are on a criminal jury.
Forgive me if I misquote your opponent, but I gather he's not sure whether or not counsel had an opportunity to expand upon once he was denied the right of peremptory challenge.
I can state unequivocally that once the judge denied the peremptory challenge, defense counsel was not allowed to reason.
Was not allowed to or didn't ask?
He didn't ask, but they didn't go into that.
His Honor didn't offer it to him, or there was no indication that that possibility existed?
No, he did not offer. He didn't talk about it. He didn't say whatever.
It's perfectly possible, and I'm sure you've seen it happen, that you can work it to a challenge for cause if you give him sufficient opportunity.
Exactly.
You pause at a threshold, you decide whether to use it peremptory, you decide to use it, and in the old days, of course, that was the end of that. But if you decided you want to save the peremptory, you went on now, further interrogation to find out whether or not.
And in honesty, my experience in Indiana trial courts, just from my experience, trial level cases, a lot of time what happens is that the judge allows voir dire to take place, okay, and does not, and requires both your challenges for cause and your peremptory challenges after you have completed your round of voir dire.
That's become fairly universal.
Yeah, and so, you know, in this case, I don't know for sure, but the problem here, I would submit, is that the judge was misapplying the principles of Batson and the cases.
Excuse me, were the peremptories, by the way, an open court with the jurors there, or were they done with sidebar? Do you all know that?
I believe they were at the sidebar.
Thank
in other
God.
Words, the parties approached the bench to discuss their justifications. And I think you'll notice also there were times when jurors were actually questioned individually about certain embarrassing subjects and so forth.
You mean they sent the other jurors out?
I think maybe they had them come up to the bar, come up to the bench.
The other case that you noted,
Donnell Curran?
Yes. Now, that was also a capital case.
No, it was a Class A felony robbery.
Okay, but the same judge.
The same judge, Judge Letzinger from Lake County, correct?
Using the same format.
It's somewhat unclear, but I'm assuming it is because in reading the opinion, it's not exactly.
In any event, he wouldn't allow a peremptory, and the Supreme Court thought he should have.
Right, correct. The troubling thing.
Can I get back to your answer to your opponent's argument, certainly in his brief and this afternoon as well, that in a sense, so what? If you prove that the every in and out of the Batson doctrine as it's been developed in the Supreme Court wasn't followed, how does that add up to a constitutional violation? Why can't the state of Indiana do it differently?
The problem here is that, number one, I would submit that the judge was actually racially stereotyping the parties. Specifically, Akipuam was a black defendant, and I believe Mr. Lyles was an African-American trial attorney. In some of the discussion about this procedure, Judge Letzinger is talking about, you know, since McCollum was decided, since this Carr versus Georgia denial of cert or grant a certain remand,
right,
that a black could not strike a white without a sufficient justification. In other words, we would submit that, in effect, what happened here, the judge presumed that because he was a black African-American defendant and trial counsel, that he was exercising his peremptory challenges on the basis of racial stereotyping.
Well, he had it almost right. He can't strike it just because he's white.
Right. And I think that's what's troubling is that what you have going on here is some racial stereotyping, and simply because, the state argues that the prosecutor was required to offer explanations also. Simply because he's applying that to both the state and the defendant doesn't make it right under the 14th Amendment.
On this record, the state had no objection to these four peremptory challenges, isn't that right?
Correct. They made no.
That's
I don't
what
believe
I understood
they did.
Anyway,
there was one where the prosecutor finally decided that, well, you know, he would, I believe, decided that he would take the mantle of arguing.
Seeing which way the wind was blowing, he'd get in front of it.
Correct. The other question I wanted to answer was about the peremptory challenge that was denied that was not raised. I think it was Juror Bodos. Of course, we received this case in habeas, and this issue was raised on direct appeal. When you look at the voir dire in trying to figure out which juror is speaking, it's very difficult at times because the prosecutor often didn't refer to them by name, and sometimes the defense counsel did not. But in looking at Juror Bodos, I only found like two sentences in the record where she was, where it was clear that she was speaking, this Juror Bodos. And so I think you know, the problem was is that, you know, it may have been not raised in direct appeal because of that, because needing a record to substantiate the claim made on direct appeal was not fair in the transcript itself.
I also must say that I was very troubled by the pseudo-psychological test.
Yeah.
Because the court never interpreted the results, never made that interpretation available to the defense, could not recall, the trial court couldn't recall how or if he used that evaluation, and I'm very troubled by
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and we're troubled, or we're presenting that claim. One thing I want to, and I tried to point this out in the lead brief, the state submits that the Indiana Supreme Court found, or that there is a finding that the trial judge did not rely on that test. But what the trial judge really said was, I don't recall. I don't know for sure. One of probably the most troubling in aspect of that pseudo-psychological test is that the judge had a trick question in there that was nonsensical. And his interpretation of that, which he offered, was that if the defendant answers that question, that suggests to me that they are dishonest.
You know, that question, actually, in some languages, that's the way you explain that you are younger. I think in Spanish,
and
older, or...
And from my history of taking tests, I think I learned over the years, I think most people learn is that, well, you don't want to leave a test question blank, because that way you're not going to get credit for it. So you might as well guess. Okay, that's not a showing of dishonesty. That is, I want to pass the test. And that
even if I don't know what's on it, now that may be dishonest.
Correct. Yes, and
do you have a response to the argument that the state has made about the fact that you did not obtain a certificate of appealability for your alternative grounds?
Yes, Judge, and to be frank, I spent a great deal of time looking at case law on cross appeals, and I read with great clarity Justice Posner repeatedly cautioning, hey,
he pronounces it Posner, by
Posner,
the way.
I'm sorry.
And it's Judge.
Judge Posner.
Oh, he really
sorry. Judge Posner repeatedly saying, you don't need to cross appeal if you are not seeking to alter or amend the judgment or seeking relief greater than what you got.
And it seems the state has conceded that you did not need to cross-appeal.
Right. If you look at the statutory language, it says that a certificate of appealability is required if you are appealing.
Right.
It doesn't say if you are seeking to review a claim. It doesn't say that. It says if you are seeking to appeal. And
well, actually, as appellee, even if you hadn't filed a brief, we could have upheld a judgment based on any ground raised before the district court.
Right, and that was the thinking. And I relied upon the Trueblood decision. I think was the most recent one that I had looked at. And alternatively, since I can't say I know the law perfectly or know and can look into the...
Go ahead. We don't know
anyone
that I would alternatively ask the court to grant us a certificate of appealability on those claims, those alternative claims that we have submitted in support of the judgment that was granted by Judge Sharp.
Okay.
I want to go back to this matter of what the judge was doing. The thing that I was, the state says that this procedure provided greater protection, okay? That this is providing greater protection for jurors and defendants and parties in the state of Indiana. The trial judge himself on page 406 of the trial record says that what he is doing here is not a greater protection. What he says, quote, this is a matter of the United States constitutional law, which has overview of all state laws unless state laws are more restrictive, which in this case they are not. Okay. In other words, he was saying that this procedure is not state law based that he's using. Okay. This is U.S. constitutional law that
he thought is required to do this.
He thought it was required under Batson, his progeny, the decision in McCollum, and the decision in Georgia versus Carr. And that is apparent by other statements he has made in the record. In the PCR record, there's a pretrial hearing where he tells the parties that he's going to require this.
Do any other Indiana judges follow this procedure that you know?
I know of no other Indiana judges that follow this.
So he thinks they're all operating unconstitutionally.
He says on page 101, this is in the PCR record, a pretrial hearing that was subsequently transcribed. And you got to remember, too, that since Carr versus Georgia, black can't strike a white. McCollum versus Georgia, a white can't strike a black. Nobody can strike anybody without some reason. Okay? He is not saying that this is state law that I'm going to apply and require this justification.
Well, as a matter of fact, the black cannot strike blacks just because they're black.
Correct.
Or whites cannot strike whites just because they're white.
Fascinating. And he repeatedly says that. I mean, and in my brief, to be honest, I submitted that what the judge was doing here, I submitted that the record supported that he was racially stereotyping the African-American, that he was striking white jurors simply because of their race. And I don't think there was anything in the record to support that assumption. And there's no showing that...
Is there anything in the record about the makeup of the total minority?
There is nothing that I could determine in terms of the racial makeup. And to be frank, I did search the trial court's files to see if there was anything there. Often the questionnaires are gone shortly after.
What do they do, throw them away? Or?
I mean, that's been my experience in some courts. I don't know for sure about this one.
Storage problem, probably.
Yeah.
Now we have computers. You can put everything in a dot about the size of a quarter.
The other thing is that defense counsel says in offering his justifications on page 405 of the trial record, he says, I haven't alluded to anybody's race, Judge, in his questioning, in his voir dire, nothing. There is no indication in his questioning that race is playing any role in his decision making. The judge says, you don't have to, okay? He says, you don't have to, okay? In essence, the judge says, it doesn't matter. I'm presuming, number one, that your strikes are racially motivated. Now,
conclusively presuming.
Yeah. The other thing that I wanted to respond to was there Mr. Creason is correct. There is no finding of discriminatory intent anywhere in this record.
Do you think there is? Here's the problem. If this were a direct criminal appeal, we say over and over again that the district courts have the obligation to explain to us what they're doing so that we can make an intelligent decision on appellate review. My question for you is how much of that carries over to habeas corpus with a silent record, as we appear to have on this central question of intentional discrimination. Does something analogous to that rule apply? Do we have to be able to find some positive indication in the record that the state trial judge did what he was supposed to do, or for that matter, the Indiana Supreme Court, which also never utters the word intentional discrimination? Or should we presume that they knew what the law was and they were doing what they should have done? What do we do?
I submit that the record has to support, and there has to be something in the record. If you're going to assume there was some sort of finding, if you're going to suggest that this is an implicit finding. There has to be something in the record to support that, even under 2254. There has to be some fact, some evidence, other than he's a black defendant and the juror was white. There has to be something more. And that's
so silence won't do.
I submit that silence will not do. But I think in this case, you know, if you assume for the sake of argument, okay, that the judge could do what he did, okay, the Indiana Supreme Court did not apply Perkett versus Elam in clear contravention of Griffith versus Illinois, right, Griffith versus Kentucky. That's crystal clear in this case. I would submit that this procedure, okay, did violate Occoquan's due process rights. Under state law, the state of Indiana gives defendants peremptory challenges. You cannot arbitrarily and capriciously deny those peremptory challenges and be consistent with the 14th Amendment, which accords every defendant due process of law. I'd also submit he was denied equal protection of the law under the 14th Amendment by this procedure, because unlike every other defendant in the state of Indiana, the court denied his peremptory challenges based on the assumption that there was discrimination occurring.
Every other defendant except the ones appearing before him.
Yeah, correct. The troubling thing here is that Batson and all his progeny was turned on its head. The burden, if you assume that there was discrimination found by the trial judge, the burden was put on the party seeking to exercise the challenge. Batson, in every case decided after that, says the burden of proving discrimination is on the opponent or the party who says you're not entitled to that strike because you're discriminating. Simply because it's the judge intervening sua sponte doesn't mean that the judge can place the
it's
burden,
the burden of production, not the burden of proof.
Yes. Yes.
We can show that by the pattern that there's intentionally getting rid of all the blacks or all the whites,
right,
or all the women or all the
right, I think
tall men are short. No, they're not. They're not suspect. Are they? Tall men are not the suspect.
But I think
bald-headed men are.
That makes me one, then I guess. The judge went further. He placed. I believe he placed the burden of persuasion on the party seeking to strike to show that he's not discriminating, and that's clearly violative of the principles of Batson. There's no Batson case that says that the party exercising the strike has the burden of showing that he didn't intend to discriminate. We would ask the court to affirm the judgment of Judge Sharp and make the writ issue and require the state of Indiana to retry or release Mr. Occoquan. Thank you, Judge.
In rebuttal, Your Honors, defendant or petitioner has not pointed to a specific United States Supreme Court test that or a case that has prohibited the procedure that was used here. And
did you ever find one where it was used before?
Pardon me, Your Honor.
Any case that you can find where this procedure was used at all?
No, Your Honor. The United States Supreme Court hasn't had. It appears they haven't had the opportunity,
well,
or at least have not.
Maybe you'll give them a shot at it.
That very well may be, Your Honor, but absent clearly established federal law that binds in petitioner's favor here, the standard of review of this court on habeas review precludes that review. As I'm sure this court is well aware of and recently reiterated in Hardaway v. Young, where this court had severe concerns about an Illinois procedure that was used.
Do you want to respond to Perkett?
The Perkett decision says you should not confuse the second and third prongs of the Batson test. And the Indiana Supreme Court, And the trial court, although not as clear, the Indiana Supreme Court did not. At some points it said this was a reasonable, like, this was a race-neutral reason, but because it was not based on anything in the record of this procedure which we're approving, then it does not pass the believability part of the test. The Court of Appeals in the Eighth Circuit in Perkett utterly confused the two and said that on the face they had to be believable, and that is not what the Indiana Supreme Court required here. So the state believes that
they said it, on its face it had to be well supported in the record. What's the difference?
I believe the Indiana Supreme Court, Your Honor, is clear and reasonably specific, implying in the record.
Right, but they were quoting from what the trial judge had said, and the trial judge was saying, when you tell me about your impressions, that's just too vague. I want some specifics. I want some support in the record. And the trial judge made similar comments for each of these four jurors. And I know the exact phrasing is different, but what at its essence is different between that and what was criticized in Perkett?
Because the trial court, and on appellate review, the Indiana Supreme Court was giving discretion to the... giving deference to the trial court. The trial court said this was a euphemism for a racially motivated strike at one point in time. The state believes that that is an equivalent to, I believe that the reason behind your proposed strike is a racially motivated one. In other words, a roundabout way of getting to the intentional discrimination, which Your Honor has asked for. In light of that, state requests that you reverse the grant of habeas relief in this case.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Kreese, and thank you, Mr. Westerfeld. The court will take the case under advisement. We want to thank you for your fine briefs and your fine argument. And the court will be in recess until
tomorrow
morning.
Give her a chance to hear it.